Well, since Mark prayed for us, I won't be redundant, even though I love doing that, because I know we often come here with, you know, the day's trouble and anxieties. So anyway, God is with us, and I know he'll bless our evening. I'm glad you guys came, that you took time to want to be here. So that means a lot. So thanks. I think what I want to do this evening is go through some images of my work first, and then I'll talk. That just seemed like a better transition than the other way around, because I can get long-winded, and this way I'll have a cutoff time. Just by way of introduction, most of y'all know this, except I guess Mark and Maggie know less, and Gwen, you and your family know. David, y'all know me even lesser. So, but anyway, well, on a personal note, I met Mark during one of our build-ups for ArtReach. I go to Christ Chapel, and so it was one year, I think it was last year's ArtReach, and he was just getting ready to come over here, I think, at that time when we met, and then he joined a small group that I have on Saturdays where we're actually doing a marriage study, and this was before he was married, and so he wasn't allowed to speak until just a few weeks ago, and now he can contribute that he's married. He's doing great. And so anyway, I'm very thankful for my friendship with Mark and the way that's been unfolding over the last few months. Jessica and I, we live here in Fort Worth. We've been here since 2001. Prior to that, we were in Italy, and I was studying there. I started my career in architecture. I studied architecture at A&M. I moved to Colorado. That's where I met Jessica, and she was in interior design at the time. And we met through friends who were both involved with the Navigator Ministry in our respective colleges, and so they thought, well, she's a designer, he's an architect, they would make a good pair, and so we got set up, and it worked out really great, and so we got married when we were, actually I had was in transition when we got married, and I was my love for architecture has not changed, but my dissatisfaction with my day-to-day work experience was getting increasingly difficult. And so I decided I really wanted to pursue my art, and that just began to build. I took a year off because the other side of me has always been drawn to ministry. And I took a year off and went through a program called the Biblical Counseling Program through Colorado Christian University, and it was headed up by Larry Crabb and Dan Allender and some other men and women, and it was there in Colorado, and so I took a year off and did that, and during that experience, many of my profs kind of really encouraged me to pursue my art there, and so when I got out of school, that's kind of what I really wanted to do, and then after a couple of years of painting and teaching, I found out about the Florence Academy of Art, and there were some other schools in New York I wanted to go to, and Jessica really pushed Italy, and because of that, I felt the freedom to go there, and so we did. We went to Italy, and I studied at the Florence Academy of Art for 3 years. We were there 4 years. The fourth year we were there, my oldest daughter was born. We have two girls, Annalisa and Isabella, and they are 9 and 7 now. And so, all that to say, I started my career in architecture, and then I was really untrained as an artist, and then I got this very formal, academic, figurative training, you know, in the tradition of figurative art and realism and naturalism. And so that, it really changed me, too. I mean, the style I was working in prior to that was moving toward realism, but not like this, not anything like this. And so it really changed, it didn't change my vision for my art, but it changed the mode that I was working in, the medium, if you will, and the way I wanted to communicate. So I'll go through a few slides. These pieces that I'm going to show you first are more recent pieces. This is called Falling Man. It's about, and most of these, I'm starting to paint larger in scale now. This is 40 by 40 inches. And so, you know, you can see it's fairly refined realism and naturalism. The idea behind this was to try to communicate somebody who was in a state of complete hopelessness. There, you know, he's at the end of his rope, but his rope's broken. So there's no way out for this man. So that was the idea. And I struggled with, one of the things I struggled with was, one, what was going to be kind of in the background. And I wanted this sense of debris falling to be alongside him, to again try to communicate the idea that despair is kind of what I was after in this piece. You know, that sense of state of falling and just out of control. The other thing I struggled with was whether or not to kind of do a freeze frame type thing, or to try to blur the image, like he was actually, you know, moving. And so I began to kind of hedge a little bit and blur edges more than I would normally. What is typical of me is I'll take a piece and I'll continue to work on it even after I declare I'm finished with it. And that's an issue that I struggle with as an artist, but that's something that I did. And just recently I was forced to stop working on this because I've sent it to Italy for an exhibition there at an alumni show at the Florence Academy. Yeah, I just found out it's finally gotten to, yeah, it's supposed to arrive in Germany tonight, but it was supposed to have been there 3 days ago. So it'll go to Germany and then Milan and then down to Florence. So hopefully it won't get hung up. Okay, we'll go to the next one. This was actually the same model. This piece is called Doubt and Volition. And when I started this work, it was really just the figure in the middle. And it was a portrait that I was doing from life. And I just felt like, you know, I wanted this portrait seated under these ominous-looking clouds to kind of create a sense of mystery or suspicion about the figure. But I just felt like there wasn't much to it. And then this idea came to me about, you know, the idea of a man struggling with kind of an inner, making a decision, and kind of the inner, to try to, I guess, express that inner turmoil you might feel in making a decision. And something that's always intrigued me personally is the idea of our volitional will and choice versus, just our doubts and letting life just happen to us versus moving into life in a very volitional, intentional way. That, you know, kind of seeing that in my own life, seeing those struggles in my own life has kind of has always intrigued me to try to work that out in my work as well. And so the other two images, even though same model, I had him come back in and I got him in different poses and kind of that's kind of what came out of it. And ironically enough, this friend of mine, he's a model, but he's also a friend of mine. Ironically, his name is Thomas. Thomas Stoy.
Yeah. You know Thomas?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. He's a friend of mine, and I've.
He was one of your students.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was, and the first one was Thomas too, Falling Man, and you know, I say ironically because this is kind of my.
He modeled some for me once, and I told him about it. Yeah,
and this is kind of my Doubting Thomas, if you will. So I thought it was interesting that his name is Thomas. And Thomas has had his struggles, you know, personally, he himself. So it's interesting sometimes how all these things kind of end up working together in ways that somebody who saw the painting wouldn't really know that, but I know it, and it becomes even more meaningful
and
to me.
What I know about Thomas, too, it all there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all there. You did
wonderful. Yeah, thank you. Okay, next one. This is called Naive's Descent, and you know, I kind of struggled with it because I wasn't sure if it was kind of right there on that border of kitsch or something really cool, you know. And, you know, the idea is, you know, as kids grow older, they experience more of life, which means they experience more disappointment in their life in some circumstance or some manner. And with that comes a loss of their naivete. You know, and when I say naivete, I mean not naive as in a willful foolishness, but naive as in the innocent, unknowing sense. And so that was also kind of significant in the positioning, in that Annalisa, our oldest, is dropping further. Isabella is still closer to the heavens, if you will, closer to that kind of innocence that they're born with. Not that I don't believe that, I believe, you know, we're born into a need for salvation, but children are relatively innocent, you know. Okay.
If somebody else had done that, like if I had done that, mm-hmm. It would have moved over into the excellence keeps it out of that.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about how so much is not done really well.
Yeah.
And it.
Yeah.
Most people can't articulate it that well.
Yeah. Thanks. This is called Between the Eternities. And this piece, it was kind of an accidental thing in that I was just sitting outside one day in the front porch, and my kids were out playing, and Isabella is our real athlete, and she was running and jumping, and I got the camera, and I got this really lucky shot of her actually right in that position. She wasn't wearing that dress. It was a blue dress, I think, wasn't it? Or it was her nightgown or something like that. But I kept looking at that image thinking, that's a really cool image. And then finally, you know, I decided I'm really going to try to do something with that. And this piece is large. It's 6 feet by 4 feet. So it's 6 feet high by 4 feet. So the figure is life size. So at that time she was all, you know, 36 inches or more, so it's life size for her. And so that's kind of where the idea began to brew. The title, Between the Eternities, really came from a miniseries film, a film, if you will, that I saw with Robert Duvall, and it was a Western, and he was, as usual, very philosophical. And whenever somebody would die in the movie and he would give his eulogy, it was kind of this memorized prayer. But one of the last lines was that we pass between the eternities. And his soliloquy and his prayer was about the idea of how we pass through this lifetime from one eternity onto the next. Well, this daughter, our youngest daughter, she, in her likeness, she really looks like her grandmother, Jessica's mom. And Jessica's mom, at the end of her life, was afflicted with ALS. And we saw her move from being an incredibly healthy woman of 70-plus years, almost 80. Yeah, coming to visit us, going across, taking us on vacations to Hawaii, going across the world, traveling to Australia, Europe, whatever. And we saw her move from that to being crippled, to being in a wheelchair, to not even being able to raise her hands, to then not being able to speak, and then lastly, not being able to breathe. And we were with her when she died. And so in some ways, I felt like it was kind of a memoriam to her and her life, because our daughter, our youngest, Isabella, looks like her and kind of has her spirit, if you will, her vivaciousness and liveliness. And that movie between, I can't remember the name of it, that Robert Duvall Western, that was one of the last visits Jessica and I had with Janie, Jessica's mom, before she was afflicted and had to move in with Jessica's sister. And so it was just kind of a sweet memory, and that line just grabbed me. There was something about the poetry of that statement, that line, but we pass between the eternities, that I thought, I just have to use that somehow, because it seems so powerful. And so that's why I titled it. This painting was called, I forget, Broken Arm, Big Dreams. Our oldest daughter had broken her arm. She had this garish pink cast. And I saw this really cool painting, and it was, you know, from probably the 19th century, from not Sargent, but a Sargent-esque style painting of this little girl with a sling. Her arm was broken or something. It was in a sling. And it was just so moving, simple, straightforward kind of painting. And I thought, I want to do that, but I've got this pink cast. And so what am I going to do with that? And anyway, the whole idea just kind of evolved from there. But the idea, the kind of the end idea was, here she is on this boat sailing forward, and she was undaunted by her arm, and she kept such a positive outlook and hopefulness. And so that's where the title came from, Broken Arm, Big Dreams, because in spite of her arm, you know, she wasn't letting go of her dreams. And she got back, she broke it on her bike and got back on her bike with her cast, you know, as soon as she could. So that was that one. Okay, now we're getting, I'm going to speed this up. This one is called Woman with a Burden. This one and then the next three I'm going to show you are all currently on exhibit at the Museum of Biblical Art in Dallas. This painting, however, is now not on loan, but is down in Houston because it was picked to be in a competition called the Hunting Prize competition, which, and I had to do it because the prize is just so worthwhile. If I were to win, it would be real significant if I were selected. But anyway, all that to say, I like this painting a lot. And again, it was one of those things where I just felt like it was an expression of, you know, it reminds me of the passage in, Matthew 11, 28, or Matthew 11, 28, where Christ says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Let me take your burden. And I just felt like, again, with a woman figure, it would express that even better than with a male figure. With a male figure, it might tend to look like Atlas or something like that, you know, holding up the world. But with a woman, it just seemed to be a very appropriate expression of being burdened. And that's what I wanted to try to communicate. Okay, Mark. This is called Lazarus' Dream. And there's this homeless guy that I got for the model. No, I'm kidding. It's me. I say that because my studio is on East Lancaster across from the Union Gospel Mission. But the idea behind this was Lazarus in that state before Christ frees him from death. And the idea is he is overwhelmed. The burial cloth is meant to kind of express the idea of being overwhelmed with the inability to free yourself. And kind of the idea that he's trying to clip his way with these ridiculous small scissors out of the burial cloth that symbolizes him being trapped in death. And then Christ frees him and, you know, says, unwrap him, take off his burial clothes. So that was kind of the idea here with this one. This one, yeah, it was on exhibit at the Community Arts Center. So that may have been where you saw it. And it's also at the Museum of Biblical Art. And then these next two, Mark, are fabric studies that I did, because I was really struggling with the fabric, and it just looked so naively painted. And then I just kind of forced myself to slow down and do these smaller studies. You can show the next one too. And to kind of help me figure out and work out the fabric. So sometimes I find I've got to slow down and just observe things. Being a realist, you know, a lot of what I do is really trying to observe what I actually see. And there's a kind of humility that takes place, and you begin to really observe what you see instead of imposing what you think you see on what you're seeing, you know. I've learned a lot about humility by what it means to paint as a realist, you know, and try to paint accurately what you see in front of you. Okay, Mark. This one is called Beautiful Feet, and those of you at Trinity have seen this, and this is also at the Museum of Biblical Art, and those are Thomas's feet. And after I nailed in that nail, we rushed him to the hospital, but he is recovered. He is recovered, yeah, yeah. But this one, you know, I've seen, as an artist, I have always wanted to paint a crucifix. That just seems like, for me as a Christian, as an artist, that feels like, hey, I can show the Lord how much I love him. I don't know why, it feels that way to me. It's like, God, what can I do for you? You know, I can paint a beautiful figure on a cross that represents your suffering. And that has always been kind of a dream that somebody would commission me to do that, you know, a church or something, you know, to do a really big one or something. And so I've wanted to do that, but then I started thinking, you know, crucifixes have been done and done and done and done again. And I thought, what would be an interesting way to communicate that in a new way, a fresh way? And I just began to think about, I began to look at old images of crucifixes and kind of where Christ's body was positioned. And sometimes he's high off the ground, sometimes he's low to the ground in some of the older medieval images. And the people are gathered around the cross, like his mother and some other disciples, and it's a, you know, it's obviously a sign of you know, adoration and worship and grieving. And I just began to feel like, you know, if you were faced with the image of Christ and his sacrifice for you, you would just want to throw your arms around him. And I began to think about what that would be like if I were there at the crucifix, you know, and how overwhelmed you might feel. And so I thought, you know, I want an image that's going to arrest people and really make them want to go and wrap their arms around Christ in some way. It's hard to articulate these things, but I just wanted that sense of feeling to well up in somebody when they saw this image. And so I, you know, I decided on this image that would just show Christ's feet only. And there were so many, you know, there's so many scriptural references to 2 feet being something that represents humility, like washing someone's feet, and how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. And so, you know, again, I just felt like it would be a new way to present this idea of Christ's suffering in just a different way, in a way that would be unique for me. And so I'm, you know, this is one of those images that I feel like, oh, wow, I think I got it. You know, this is, maybe this will be my hit record, you know, kind of thing. Yeah.
And it's clean enough where it's not.
Yeah.
He's very approachable.
Yeah, and that's another thing I struggled with, is whether or not I should make it more bloody, to use the term. You know, I had seen Mel Gibson's Passion, and I just felt so, you know, for me, I thought, wow, how incredibly awesome that he was able to use all his resources to put together a declaration of his faith and put it out there for the world to see, you know, irregardless of the way it came out and what people think of it or whatever. You know, that was him saying, here's my way of blessing you back, God. And that's what I struggled with, you know, should I make it seem more rough, or should I keep it like it is? I don't know. I still go back and forth. So, in these images, you can't see all the detail that well. Yeah, I think I tried to find that balance. So. And then, of course, that red cloth at the bottom kind of represents, again, the symbolic of his blood. Okay. This is called Vanity, Vanity. And I really like this piece too, and it's kind of these next few pieces kind of represent the idea of the vanitas genre of painting that you saw from the old Dutch masters, really, in Northern Europe and in Italy as well. But it's the idea of, you know, infusing these still lifes with symbols that would remind you of the brevity of life and the importance of focusing on the spiritual instead of the material world. And so they were always filled with symbols like an hourglass to represent time, the skull or bones to represent mortality, money to represent the vain pursuit of material wealth, of worldly wealth, and books to represent the vanity of pursuit of knowledge, pursuit of knowledge apart from Christ. And then the little child's drawing, the vanity of art, you know. So you often see those kinds of symbols. And then the butterfly was an ancient symbol that represented the soul. And I thought that was interesting, and that's why I liked putting that in there. And they had this nice little pink butterfly that I've used in a couple of pieces. So that was the idea behind this. And then also most still lifes, you know, are, you're looking at a shelf straight on as opposed to looking down on top of a table. And I thought that vantage point was interesting. Kind of an interesting twist that would make it seem like, okay, what, you know, is it the Spirit of God looking down on her? Is it just us looking down, you know, or just, well, that's an interesting vantage point, you know. This is called, let's see if I remember, Of Whom the World Is Not Worthy, is the title of this. And again, it was the idea, kind of a take off that vanitas still life genre, but again, I've kind of tried to infuse it with a real figure in there, and the idea is, you know, the idea from Hebrews of how The original title of this painting was called Cantilever, because the idea was this thing's cantilevered out there, and the little monk kind of symbolizes a man stepping out on his faith. But, you know, we step out in faith, and we step out in faith. We always hear the stories in church of how, you know, I just stepped out in faith and everything worked out. Well, Hebrews clearly says there were men and women who stepped out in faith and things did not work out. You know, they met their end tragically. Not tragically, really, but you know what I mean. I mean, in a worldly sense, it was tragic. They became martyrs for the Lord, and so, therefore, in the end, it's not tragic at all. You know, but the idea was stepping out in faith doesn't always end happily. Okay, Mark. This is called My Days Are a Handbreadth, which comes from that verse, I think Psalm 39:5. And so again, it's kind of peppered with these symbols that represent kind of the vanitas genre of things. This is called Don't Do It. And this was kind of my humorous take on the marriage story between Adam and Eve in the fall. And so obviously you've got the temptress, you've got the angel guarding the way back into the garden. He is stuck, literally. He in the middle.
Oh.
He is stuck in the middle, and there's no going back. And what's forward is this darkness, and you know, you see the decaying plants and the withering of the vine and the plants and the trees. And his only option is to reach up. And again, that's Thomas before he cut his hair. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Mark. Oh, I wanted to kind of, again, kind of by way of humor, kind of frame them in, you know, you see the old medieval images with the halos behind them. You know, they were flat circles. So that was kind of that idea. And then the sun and the moon idea as well. Hers is silver and hers is the sun. So. Yeah, and Thomas is his hair. And so it was kind of a play on geometry as well. I thought, you know, the shape of his hair kind of led me to those things around them. So the I Love New York, yeah, taking a bite of the Big Apple. It's silly, I know.
I remember the art show.
But it was fun to do.
Dallas, and this one was up that night, and I remember standing there, and we were all like, "Hey, what do y'all think? What do y'all think?"
Yeah.
And we were trying to figure it out. So I'm so glad you explained it.
Yeah. Well,
I wouldn't even close.
People are usually very troubled by Isabella holding that machete. That's very troubling. In her little cherry dress.
Yeah.
Maybe they just don't know little girls that age.
Well, and I'm a
she was your age.
Yeah, I was going to say, she put on her fluffiest dress and go get her pink rifle or something. And
yeah.
The contrast is often.
Okay, Mark. Okay, these are just, you can scroll through these pretty quick. These are just kind of straightforward portraits, drawings. You guys may know her. That's Melissa Schrader. You know her? She goes to church here. This is called Topiary Still Life, and it is, again, kind of a bit of a humor thing. You know, that's a little cutout image of Masaccio's Expulsion, which was a famous fresco in Italy. And it's a scene, one of the scenes is the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the garden. And the angel is flying behind them with a sword, you know, prodding them out of the garden. And they're, you know, grieving and weeping as they go. Well, that's kind of the representing the idea of the garden, the perfect, kind of symbolizing the perfect, the perfection they were having to leave. Okay, so the idea of the Garden of Eden, and you know, you go into these perfectly manicured gardens and lawns, and you know, I always feel like this is like a little taste of Eden here. You know, when you walk over through the west side and the neighborhood along the golf course there. this was called Hope. And this was I don't want to show the last one. No, the last one is just has a nude figure, and I just don't want to show it here now. This was called Hope, and it was just an idea of, I'd always kind of been intrigued with the idea of superstition and religion and where those things kind of come together, and then all how that related to fertility. Because when Jessica and I were in Italy, we tried to get pregnant for a few years before we actually did, because we were having fertility issues. And I just remember thinking a lot about ancient cultures and their little fertility icons, and how, whether it was, you know, thousands of years ago to today, people still struggle with the same issue, even though we have so much technology to try to help us overcome infertility. It is still as much of a core struggle in the hearts of human beings today as it was then. And people created these, you know, these little fertility dolls to pray to or whatever to try to invoke fertility. And we use technology to try to, you know, help with overcoming infertility. And I just, I was just thinking about that as Jessica and I were struggling with our own issues with that. And so these next three pieces are about that. And this is called Out of Air. And then the next one. Oh, not that one. And that's it. That's so. We'll just end it there. Yeah. The last one was Jessica pregnant. So that was kind of the culmination of. Yeah. That was the happy ending. Very happy. Okay. How are y'all doing? Anybody need a break? Yeah. When do we end, Mark? When do we end? Okay. All right. Well, I'll just kind of give an overview of thoughts of what I was going to share tonight, and then we can kind of go a little deeper if y'all want to. Something that I've really been thinking a lot about, I guess it comes obviously from my own personal life, is how important our devotional life is as artists, and how important it is to nurture and cultivate our devotional life. Now, I think we would all agree that, oh yeah, it's important to have a devotional life, but why? Why is it important for us as artists who are Christ-following people? Why is it important, particularly to the artists, to cultivate a devotional life? And four areas that I see that make it significant is that, first, we are on the front line of culture. Now, I know not every artist sees themselves that way, and not every artist chooses to put themselves out there like that. And that's okay. There are many artists that are, you know, they are very creative and they do their art, but they don't see themselves kind of as being there on the forefront of culture, and that's okay. They don't have to be. It's a choice that I think some artists make and move into. But for those who move into it, you know, we really are on the front line if we choose to be there. And, you know, the French term for frontline soldiers was the avant-garde. And so for us as artists, you know, we have the opportunity to be the avant-garde in our culture, in our respective culture. And it can be small in our respective communities, our church, or it can be at large, like somebody like Mako, who we heard the other night, who's all over the world, you know, on the front line of culture. And so we all have a place there, somewhere, and we can move further out there if we want or not. But I think for us as artists, it's very important that we recognize that in relationship to our devotional life. You know, Francis Schaeffer, I brought some books I wanted to show you guys. Francis Schaeffer, I have these really great things called The Complete Works of Francis Schaeffer. I think it's in 5 volumes, but it has everything he's ever written. Like, there are 5 or 6 books in this one volume here. But in Escape from Reason, he says that, you know, the typical line of influence on culture begins with the philosophers and the writers, and then into art, like painting and music, and then into mass media, and then it disseminates into culture. And so, you know, artists really are up there at that point where they are kind of out there leading, if you will, or they can be. Well, they are. So they are. And so therefore, the question becomes, how are you leading and what are you leading people to? Okay. So I see that, you know, the fact that artists are part of the avant-garde, the frontline soldier, as being important. Now, there are always things that impact our culture from the outside, like the 9/11 attacks and the subsequent wars that our culture's engaged in, and like the economic meltdown and all of the corruption that has exposed, both the political and financial corruption that's exposed. I've spent a lot of time listening to commentators about that, and it seems like the common thread that I've heard from all of them is just a complete breakdown and lack of accountability, and that nobody was accountable to nobody. Everybody was out for themselves. And it reminds me of one professor I had in college who said, he did his dissertation on the book of Judges, and he said Judges is a postmodern work, meaning that idea that everybody did what was right in their own eyes. That's kind of where we are. Everybody just does what's right in their own eyes. You know, they're not accountable to anything higher. And so, you know, even though things impact our culture that don't have to do with artists, artists have the opportunity to respond to that. How are we going to respond to what has happened politically, financially, to whether it's the 9/11 attacks or whether it's the financial meltdown or political corruption that we see? How are we going to respond? Secondly, we are moral agents, and what we do impacts the world. We're all endowed, everybody is endowed with a sense of agency, meaning that we have the gift and freedom to act and make choices and impose those choices on the people around us. So we all have agency. We all are moral agents. And, you know, how we impact the world around us reminds me of that, you know, the idea of, by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, that he wrote, I found it today, it comes from the Gulag Archipelago, you know, that he says basically the line between good and evil begins in us. And I'll read you this quote. It's incredible. He says, I think he was in prison when he wrote this. He said, gradually it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor through classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart. This line shifts inside us. It oscillates with the years, and even within the hearts overwhelmed with evil, one small bridgehead of good is retained. And even in the best of all hearts, there remains an uprooted small corner of evil. And so he's saying, even in the worst person, they can do good. And even the best people, there remains in them a small corner of depravity. Again, emphasizing our constant need for Christ, our constant need for a Savior. And so, you know, our sense of moral agency, that and that we are on the front line, those kind of work together. And those kind of open the door to the analogy of artist as prophet, or kind of that idiom of artist seen as prophet, or artists have that opportunity to be prophets. And, you know, prophets, if you think about it, they stand on the edge outside the camp, and they call back and speak into it and say, look at where we're going, or look at where we've been. And they call attention to something. And that's what an artist has the opportunity to do, to speak prophetically into the world around them. You know, we all have that opportunity as artists to speak prophetically through our work. And so how are we going to speak, and what are we going to speak about? Thirdly, similar to the first two, but it's about freedom, and that we are all essentially free. The scriptures say we are free to choose God's way, or we're free to choose the enemy's way. But the Bible teaches there's a consequence to the choice, and then the analogy begins to shift to that of slavery and freedom, slavery versus freedom, and that when we choose the way of the enemy, we become enslaved to sin. But when we come into relationship with Christ, we're released from that slavery into a state of freedom. And so then the idea becomes that Paul goes over and over with is, what are you going to do with your freedom? What's going to come into your freedom? What's going to fill that freedom? You know, what's your choice going to be with that now that you are free in Christ? And then the analogy shifts again to where he becomes a bond slave of Christ. So it's almost like I'm going to still choose slavery, but it's going to be to my Savior. I'm going to be enslaved to serving him. And I just think that was a very interesting sequence. But it comes back to the idea that we are free. If we know Christ, we are free. And as artists, we are called to do something with that freedom and to live a certain way in that freedom and to not take advantage of that freedom or misuse it. And I don't mean that probably in the sense that you're thinking, like drinking, smoking, whatever. I mean it more, how are we going to fill, you know, how are we going to fill our, I guess, the essence of who we are, you know? What are we going to fill that with? Because we are free before Christ, and because of him we are free. And so, you know, if we don't manage our freedom well, you know, the scriptures say that we'll end up back into slavery, to bad habits. Not that we're going to lose our salvation, but we'll be enslaved to something lesser. You know, I guess it's the difference between choosing the good versus choosing the best. Yeah, stewardship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a lot I wanted to say on freedom, but I'm going to move to the next point. The fourth point is that we are worshiping beings, and we were created to be enthralled with greatness. And so as artists, we are always trying to position ourselves to where we experience that so that we can communicate that. Okay? We are, even though we're self-oriented and selfish, we still long to connect with the sense of otherness that's greater than ourself. And we all do that. All mankind seeks out greatness. And that's why man has always been drawn to the sea, the mountains, the deserts, outer space. I mean, we want something that's bigger than us. And we want to get in touch with that thing that is bigger than us. And so for us as believers, you know, we have the opportunity to help be these kind of undercover worship leaders, if you will. You know, we have an opportunity as artists to be worship leaders. And what do we call the musicians? The musical artists in our church who sing and play, we call them worship leaders. They're leading us in worship through their art, you know. And so we have opportunity as artists, whatever our medium is, to invite people to worship, to invite people to see that greatness and that otherness through our work. Okay, those are just a few thoughts on why our devotional life is so important. Principles for nurturing an intimate devotional life with Christ. Those are, you know, I've got, you know, four things that stand out. Relational intimacy with Christ, prayer, humility, and developing liturgy. And what I mean by those is relational intimacy. You know, it's interesting. I've found scriptures that emphasize. Let me just read this one. This has always intrigued me. Yeah. It says, "For the this is Proverbs 3:32. For the devious are an abomination to the Lord, but he is intimate with the upright." Meaning, for those who obey him, those who he has redeemed, he is intimate with them. And I long for intimacy with Christ. I don't know about you guys, but that's just been a growing thing in me and in my life, that I just long for intimacy with God. I want to be close to him. I don't want to just take it on faith that we have a relationship. I want to know him. I want him to put his arm around me. I want to walk with him. I want to talk to him. I want to have conversation with him. I want an intimate, deep relationship with Christ. And then I found another one, Psalm 25:14. It says, it's interpreted this way, "The secret of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he will make them know his covenant." The secret of the Lord. And the way that's interpreted is counsel or intimacy. Counsel or intimacy. And then in John 14, 14:21. And I know you guys have heard this one. Christ says, "He who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. He who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and will disclose myself to him." He will show himself to us. When we choose to obey him, he chooses to show himself to us in deeper, more intimate ways. And I just am, I'm just very intrigued with this interrelationship and that correlation, that when I choose to obey him and turn my life over to him, then he is in deeper intimacy with him, with me. He chooses to be more intimate with me. And I just, to me, that's quite significant, because I know the core struggles that I have had, you know, that I've struggled with. For me, it's been just self-centeredness and anger have kind of been my core struggles. And even just recently, God has been healing me more and more of those things as I have chosen to yield to Him in those areas. And I don't know how that's going to affect my work directly as an artist, but I feel more free. I know that. And I feel more and more free to be bold in what I say as an artist. And I think, you know, I think that's the thing I've struggled with as an artist, is feeling inhibited. Like, it's not safe for me to be a prophet outside the camp and to speak about what I think and what I see in my own culture or the culture at large. But I feel more and more freedom to do that as I've felt more freedom from Christ, you know. And it's not from a position of anger like it used to be. You know, it used to be I wanted to shout and scream and, you know, hit you with a sledgehammer, see this and wake up. And, you know, now it's different. Now I feel just as bold, if not even bolder, but it's coming out of a place of, I don't know, it doesn't feel like it's driven with this anger behind it like it used to. It feels very different. It feels good. So we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, this time next year, we'll see what I have done that's kind of moving more toward that. Prayer, developing a method of conversation. Another friend of mine has kind of defined it as, you know, finding your voice or listening to, you know, learning your own language and having God speak that language to you. And I think for me as an artist, it's very similar to finding my own voice. You know, I think of a writer who's trying to find what's going to be their way of speaking. Which brings me to this, Madeline Lingle. You've probably all seen this and heard of her. But she talks a little bit about her own personal struggle as a writer, trying to write and find her own voice as a writer, and rejection after rejection. And then she kind of got pigeonholed as a children's writer or children's author. And at first she kind of bristled, but then she thought, well, whatever. And she, you know, the work that had been rejected began to get published kind of under that genre or under that category. And she accepted that, you know, and that was fine with her. But in the beginning, I think it was hard for her to, you know, before she found her voice, in a sense. Really? That is the same with me. I've had this book for years, and everybody talked about it when I was in school, so I thought, okay, I'm going to get it. And then everybody kept talking about it, so I thought, well, I'm not going to read it because everybody else is. I did the same thing with The Fountainhead when I was in architecture. You know, all the students were reading The Fountainhead, and I didn't read it till I was away from college and away from people and finally read it. But I just started reading it, and it's very, very good. I don't agree with everything, but I like her a lot, you know. Humility, learning to ask the right questions, learning to see.
I want to ask a question.
Yes.
Sometimes when I'm painting, it feels like worship, like you're talking about. Sometimes it feels like intercession.
Yeah.
That can be a prayer language, don't you
think? Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, humility, learning to see, learning to not impose your predispositions and assumptions onto others. We never do that, do we?
No.
But, you know, as I realize, you'd think I'd learn it, how to do that in relationships, because I've learned how to do that in art, but it's still hard for me to do that in relationships, you know, to not impose upon others. Who was it? Somebody said to me just recently, it might have been you, Mark, that the Holy Spirit was always a gentleman. No, your dad said that the other day. Ken Miller said that. The Holy Spirit, and he said, he attributed it to your granddad. He said your granddad always said the Holy Spirit was a gentleman. He wasn't going to force you or impose upon you his will. that he invited you, but it wasn't gonna force you. I thought that was an interesting picture, analogy. Developing liturgy. For me, liturgy is kind of one of those Catholic terms, and the reason why I got into it is because this last art reach we did, it was about, the theme was liturgical art, and I spent a whole lot of time trying to break down and remind people, this is Christ Chapel. No, we're not turning Catholic. No, you don't have to paint icons. No, liturgical means about worship. It's about inviting community to worship. So what are you going to do that's going to invite others to worship? And how do you worship? And so I spent a lot of time defining that. So it's been on my mind, this idea of liturgy, but developing a personal liturgy really just means developing a form in which your devotions take place. And that can be as simple as, for me, I try to get up early so I don't have the kids and everybody else pulling on me. I love drinking coffee. I love sitting in my living room alone. I love it when I can actually get up early before the sun comes up and just sit there alone in the dark and just think and pray before I start my day. Sometimes while I'm working, just listening to music and praying while I'm in my studio on the days I don't have students. I mean, whatever it is for you, let it develop into a consistent, disciplined kind of liturgy for your own devotional life, because that is your time with the Lord, and it should be special, and you can make it special. Some people like to light candles. Some people like to listen to music. Some people like to go for a walk and be in nature. Some people like to be at their desk reading and writing. Whatever it is, be free in it, but embrace it and cultivate that. Cultivate a sense of liturgy in your life. That would be my encouragement. This is another really good book for artists, writers, musicians. It's called Art and Fear, and the authors are not Christian, but they really have things to say that are very honest and truthful about the way artists struggle with confidence and self-confidence and overcoming that and learning to embrace yourself and embrace your own work and finding your own voice, that kind of thing. And so this has been really quite a good little reference book. And it goes over a lot of different aspects, from the academic world to relating to galleries to relating to or publishers or, whoever's going to, trying to think, sound engineers, no. Who makes a record? Producers. Yeah, relating to producers. I've found this book to be very encouraging. So, it's two authors, David Bailes, B-A-Y-L-E-S, Bailes or Bailes, and then Ted Orland, O-R-L-A-N-D.